Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Today on the show, we'll hear from Republican candidate Governor Taylor Haynes, who says he'll bring a conservative and constitutional approach to the governor's office.
But the only thing that I am bound and that I have said I'm going to cut is endowed, and I will.
Senator John Barrasso argues that Republicans did the right thing by trying to get rid of the Affordable Care Act.
I have people thanking me every day at home in Wyoming for eliminating this burdensome, expensive mandate that said they had to buy a government product.
And the fly fishing community has found itself in the middle of a heated debate about what it means to be an ethical angler. What started it all? A magazine cover.
The cover clearly depicted the bones coming out of that fish's tail.
We'll have those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming U.S. Senator John Barrasso has been a leading player in his party's years-long effort to repeal and replace so-called Obamacare. But the GOP has failed to deliver. Matt Laszlo caught up with him in Washington and has this story on what the GOP's Plan B, or maybe even Plan C or D, is.
Barrasso is a part of the GOP leadership team in the Senate. And he used that perch to blast the Affordable Care Act at every turn, even co-hosting the underwhelming YouTube show, The Senate Doctor Show, with Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, the only other former doctor who was in the Senate back when Obamacare was seemingly all the GOP talked about. While the GOP effort to repeal and replace Obamacare failed by one vote in the Senate, Barrasso says he's proud that his party has been able to undo parts of the health law.
We've eliminated the mandate, the most hated part of Obamacare, which has basically ripped a large hole in Obamacare.
Barrasso says voters are happy with the efforts of the GOP to dismantle Obamacare.
I have people thanking me every day at home in Wyoming for eliminating this burdensome, expensive mandate that said they had to buy a government product.
To Barrasso and others in the Republican Party, chipping away at Obamacare is good. But to Democrats, Trump and the GOP's efforts are hurting real people. New Jersey Democrat Frank Pallone says the GOP now owns the healthcare system because of their efforts to undermine the system.
He just continues to sabotage it. He's doing everything possible to sabotage it and make it harder for people to get health insurance because the prices are going to go up.
And now that the president has canceled a $10 billion payment to insurance companies, intended to be a bridge to stabilize the nation's evolving healthcare system, Pallone and other Democrats are eagerly running to preserve Obamacare this election year. He says the GOP is putting ideology above people.
It's a direct attack on consumers. I mean, who benefits? No one benefits from this. Because, you know, if he's going to argue that you're giving money that is costing federal government money, well, what about the cost when people are uninsured and they have to go to the emergency room and you have to pay for that? I mean, It's like mean-spirited, really.
But Barrasso argues the Trump administration canceled those insurance payments because a district court ruled against them. And he says it highlights how bad of a policy the Affordable Care Act was from its inception.
But this recent ruling by a court really shows that Obamacare created a mess. And the ruling shows that the regulations written by the Obama administration have made the mess worse, which is now the whole issue of whether it's even legal to make some of the payments that Obamacare mandates. And Health and Human Services, the department, is now working to try to clean up the mess that Obamacare created.
While the nation has largely been focused on immigration and tax reform, and now the open Supreme Court seat, Democrats are vowing to refocus the debate on health care ahead of November's elections. But Barrasso says that strategy won't work in the Mountain West.
We have ranchers who had insurance that worked for them before Obamacare was passed. And then under the Obama laws, it said it wasn't good enough. The ranchers said it was good enough and they could afford it, but they weren't even allowed to buy it anymore. And were told they had to buy something much more expensive that wasn't necessarily right for their family. So I'm trying to get to the point where people can buy what works for them and that they can afford. And it's about giving people the freedom and the flexibility of affordable health care.
Still, many Republicans from more purple areas are begging party leaders and the White House to pass a bill that would help stabilize the health insurance marketplace, which is witnessing soaring premiums, in part because of all the uncertainty from Congress. Pennsylvania Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick says his party's efforts to merely unwind Obamacare isn't flying with his Philadelphia area constituents.
They don't like all the labels thrown around. They want a health care system that works. They want everybody to be covered. They want a health care system that encourages innovation, that reduces costs, and makes it affordable. Right now, I believe the number one cause of personal bankruptcy is medical expenses. That's outrageous. The current system wasn't working, but the solution isn't to scrap the whole system. It's to identify what's working and keep it, find out what's not working and fix it.
But GOP leaders have brushed aside those calls for more moderate Republicans to salvage parts of Obamacare, which Barrasso stands by. He says it's better to undo Obamacare than to patch it up here and there.
You know, the issue is the court ruling in New Mexico that recently related to the fact that they're dealing with a regulation written in the Obama administration as a result of the Obamacare law. So that it's the law and the regulations itself that have created this mess. And we're trying to get some clarification ways to help prevent premiums from going up.
The GOP spent the last few election cycles running against Obamacare. But this year, Democrats have regrouped and are running on Obamacare. That means the debate isn't going away, even if the majority of Republicans still want the law to go away. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
It will soon be impossible to get oil and gas leases on 24,000 acres of the Wyoming Range. Conservation nonprofit The Trust for Public Land bought out existing leases within the Wyoming Range to maintain the area for wildlife and recreation. It's the second time the group has done this in the southeast part of the state, bringing the total number of retired acres by the trust to 80,000. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim spoke with Chris Deming, a project manager with the Trust for Public Land, to find out how it happened.
Last week, the Trust for Public Land helped protect another 24,000 acres in the Wyoming Range from oil and gas development. Working with Stanley and Mountain Energy, we successfully came up with a business solution to a conservation problem. In that, we avoided more oil and gas development in the Wyoming Range, which is an area that has been of concern over the proposed drilling as far back as the mid-1990s.
So what's problematic about this area as far as energy development, and why does wildlife and other factors supersede that?
Starting in the mid-90s, the residents of Northwest Wyoming were concerned about the impacts to wildlife, their recreational pursuits, be it hunting, fishing, or horseback riding, the impacts of the proposed oil and gas drilling to water, and the impacts to air quality. You may have heard of the Red Desert to Hoback Corridor. The collaring work and the data that has been discovered through that effort shows that much of the Wyoming Range is the summer habitat for many of those mule deer and large ungulate that travel south to north through that corridor. Those residents really galvanized around this area and helped voice their concerns over the proposed drilling, which has affected the positive conservation outcome over the last 15 years.
So was there proposed drilling there? Were there leases that were owned? Was there any active oil rigs or anything else? Or was that all held off?
There's a combination of all of the above. When the Wyoming Range effort started, one of the things that was critical to any protection work being done was the Wyoming Range Legacy Act. Starting in 2007, the late Senator Craig Thomas introduced legislation that was carried forth and approved with the support of Senator Barrasso and Mike Enzi, which designated an area of about 1.2 million acres in the Wyoming Range for future protection. Within that 1.2 million acres, no future oil and gas lease permits would be let, and any existing valid leases were eligible to be acquired by organizations like the Trust for Public Land, handed back to BLM to be relinquished and retired in perpetuity.
Is this the second part of the retirement? Has there already been some part of the Wyoming Range that was retired, or is this the first time something like this happened in the Wyoming Range?
This is the second time. The Trust for Public Land got engaged in 2010 in an effort to acquire nearly 56,000 acres of oil and gas leases from PXP, a Houston-based oil and gas company We moved forward with that, and through a successful fundraising effort, Save the Hoback campaign, we were able to acquire PXP's leases in the Wyoming Range at the end of 2012.
So I've heard you say this is a business solution to a conservation problem a few times. Can you elaborate on what that means?
Yeah, we are not an advocacy organization. We've been very successful in working with oil and gas companies such as PXP and now Stanley Energy and Mountain Energy to, in essence, acquire their oil and gas leases using private dollars to compensate them for their investment in that area. In lieu of drilling, we were acquiring those leases from them and handing them back to BLM to be retired in perpetuity.
So I think that the perpetuity part sounds pretty clear, but is there any way that this land in the future could be used for oil and gas, or it's now illegal?
There was a congressional legislation that was approved in 2009. It is part of legislation, and only way that that could be undone is if future legislation unwound what was done and put in place.
So how is this possible? Where did the money come from to be able to do this?
The recent acquisition of the Stanley and Mountain Energy leases was thanks to a generous grant from the Weiss Foundation, enabling us to move forward with the acquisition and retirement of those leases.
So what are the next steps for actually getting this land retired?
Yeah, after our acquisition on July 3rd, we've been working with BLM Wyoming to relinquish and retire the leases that we just acquired from Stanley and Mountain Energy. We anticipate that the completion of the retirement of these leases will happen within the next 30 days.
Great. Well, thanks for making time for me today, Chris.
I appreciate it.
When we come back, we'll explore the issue of migrant education. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Farm workers feed us. And to do so, they travel around the country following the harvest. For their kids, that means moving from school to school. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson found there's a system in place to help these students, and she's bringing us a story from North Dakota. I've invited her to the studio to have her explain why we're hearing about one kid in North Dakota. Tennessee, thanks for sitting down with me.
No problem.
What's happening in North Dakota that got your attention?
So this all started for me last year when I did a story about the migrant education program in Wyoming. It's a federal program that provides funds to states to provide academic support to kids whose parents move to do agricultural or fisheries work. It's a program similar to special education or free or reduced lunch, so federal dollars help states provide equity in education. And I discovered that Wyoming had decided to cancel this program.
Why did Wyoming cancel its program?
Well, changes in agriculture had reduced the demand for seasonal farm workers in the state. So in 2008, there were about 246 eligible migrant students. And in 2016, there were 148 students, according to records from the U.S. Department of Education. And people attribute that to the decline in workers. There were fewer workers, so there were fewer kids. But the state also had concerns about sharing student data. The Migrant Education Program uses something called the Migrant Student Information Exchange, and it's basically a national database that houses migrant student records, like their grades or test scores or teacher's notes. So when a student shows up at a new school, they can just get started right away. Teachers already know where they're coming from. And in Wyoming, where there's a policy of being very careful with student data privacy, this data exchange raised some concerns. Their educators just didn't like the idea that they would enter information about a student and not know who in the other state would be able to access it. But there's a lot of educators that say it's a great tool. I think kids and parents know what it's like to catch up after being sick or being out on vacation. So you could imagine what it's like to change schools a couple of times a year. And this migrant student information exchange is meant to provide some continuity. But long story short, between declining numbers and issues with sharing student data, Wyoming declined federal funds and canceled their summer programs that they'd run for the kids of sugar beet workers. And reporting on that story made me wonder if other states were in a similar situation and what they'd done.
And what did you find?
Well, I couldn't find any other state that was concerned about sharing student data. I called national experts, and this wasn't an issue on the radar of folks that I talked to in other states. And like I mentioned before, most educators told me that the information exchange was a great asset. It prevented redundancies. Kids didn't have to take the same tests or redo course material, so they could get there and teachers knew where they were at, and it really helped them to get started. I also discovered that most states have migrant education programs, and I couldn't find any other state planning to cancel it. I talked to program directors in Maine, Nevada, New Hampshire, and Vermont. These are all states that have less than 500 migrant students, which is small compared to California with over 90,000 or Texas with over 30,000. So I called up these smaller programs to see if they were thinking of quitting because their numbers were down, and they all told me that they plan to continue this program.
Where does that put us with this story that we're about to hear?
Well, with support from the Solutions Journalism Network, I actually traveled to Maine and North Dakota to see how their programs work. And the story that felt most relevant to Wyoming was what's happening in the Sugar Beet region of eastern North Dakota. They run summer programs similar to what Wyoming used to run, and they have less than 200 kids in their program this summer.
Thanks, Tennessee. Why don't you take it from here?
Angel, a tall, lanky 14-year-old, dribbles down the basketball court of the school gymnasium in Manville, North Dakota. Realizing he's unmarked, he goes for the three-pointer. It's a nice arching shot. The ball bounces tenuously on the rim and doesn't go in. It's the middle of the summer, and Angel is already thinking about trying out for his high school's basketball team later this fall, but he doesn't know if he'll be able to. Angel's parents are farm workers, and for as long as he can remember, his family has migrated between Texas and North Dakota. And every year, Angel misses the beginning of the school year in Texas, when basketball tryouts happen, because his family stays in North Dakota until the harvest is through. Could be October or November. That flexibility is a big deal for farmers, who rely on seasonal workers to quickly harvest and process crops before they spoil. But it puts those workers' kids, around 300,000 of them nationally, according to a Department of Education spokesperson, in a tough situation, making the most of a public education that's designed for students who start and finish the year at the same school. So when a lot of kids are on summer vacation, Angel's in a summer program for migrant students at the Manville School. His big goal is to complete Algebra 1.
You do line 1. Minus 4.
It's not that he didn't pass it the first time. He's working on getting ahead. Angel says back in 7th grade, his Texas school offered a test to get into the advanced math track, but he wasn't back from North Dakota in time to take it.
And they called my name, but since I wasn't there, they took me off the roster.
It bothers Angel that he couldn't take advanced math just because of his parents' work. And it isn't just academics, but activities, too. He'd like to do something called the University Interscholastic League back in Texas.
They're like competitions for mathematics, for science, history, for spelling, pretty much every subject I would like to get into, but since like we can't go over there in time, I don't have a chance to do that.
Angel's parents both grew up in farmworker families, and neither graduated from high school. His mom made it to 6th grade when her dad asked her to work in the fields to help support the family. Agricultural workers are among the country's lowest annual earners, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Angel says his mom wishes she'd been able to go to college so they wouldn't have to migrate.
She's like, I'm sorry that you have to do this. I know it hurts. You know, she feels bad for me that we have to, like, go back and forth and stuff. So that really makes me feel lucky that I have, like, the chance to, like, educate myself.
His older brother's already in college, and Angel's confident that he'll go too.
Like, I want to go to college because, you know, I don't want to work in, like, some random job to, like, make ends meet. You know, I want to live a nice life.
Angel gets a lot of help from the Migrant Education Program, which funnels federal funds to states so they can provide academic support to kids whose parents move for agricultural and fisheries work. That can mean anything from summer programs like the one in Manville to after-school tutoring to night classes and farmworker housing. The program began in the 1960s as a part of President Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty. The education department doesn't measure the graduation rate for migratory children, but advocates and educators estimate it was less than 10% when the program first started. They believe today's rate is closer to 70%. Roger Rosenthal is executive director of the Migrant Legal Action Program. Since 1980, he's worked to defend the rights of migrant students in public schools.
This program fills in the gaps that are necessary for these children to get their credits, to finish school, and to fulfill their destiny.
But not every community or every state has a program. Rhode Island, Connecticut, and West Virginia haven't had programs for years. And in 2017, Wyoming canceled its program, which is how I got interested in this story. Like North Dakota, it was the sugar beet harvest that drew large numbers of migrant workers to Wyoming. But the invention of the Roundup Ready beet reduced the need for labor by allowing farmers to control for weed growth with chemicals. Fewer migrant workers means fewer migrant students, which was part of the reason Wyoming decided to decline federal funds and no longer run the program. The numbers have declined in North Dakota, too, but Manville has held on to its migrant education program, and the federal dollars the school receives has done more than just help Angel and his peers.
Economically, it always made sense.
That's former Manville school board member and local farmer Tom Ferry. The federal funds employed teachers and bus drivers during the summer and enhanced school resources for all students throughout the year. Ferry says the program's been good for farmers, too, by drawing farmworker families to the area.
Some of the work that the program did encouraged the people to come back.
But the migrant education program can't help Angel get back to Texas in time for basketball season. Angel says his parents did give him the option to stay in Texas for the whole school year.
And I could stay with like my aunts or my grandparents, and I said, like, I don't want that because I won't feel like the same, you know?
He'd rather be close to his parents. But he's hopeful that Mother Nature won't bring an early end to this year's beet harvest so he can get back to Texas in time to try out for the basketball team. For Wyoming Public Radio in Manville, North Dakota, I'm Tennessee Watson.
When we come back, a visit with Republican candidate for governor Taylor Haynes. This is Open Spaces.
You are listening to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Dr. Taylor Haynes is running for governor as a conservative and a constitutionalist. He's a Cheyenne urologist, a rancher, and has served on a number of boards and commissions, including several years as a University of Wyoming trustee. Recently, his residency in Wyoming has been challenged, and those charges came after this interview was conducted, so it will not be part of this discussion. Haynes said this week that he has submitted evidence that should prove he is a Wyoming resident. Dr. Haynes says the state needs someone like him who wants to govern based on the Constitution. He explains to me what that means.
What we're doing wrong is we're spending money in places that don't benefit our state. Like Endow will not benefit our state. It may benefit a few employees. We need to plan our expenditures based on the purpose of government. Then that will help us with our spending, will also help us with revenues. The other thing that we haven't done, and no one else will do it, is take over management of the federally managed lands in our state that we should have had control of since we became a state. That adds a minimum of $1 billion to our state coffers annually.
Let's go back and talk a little bit about education and your thought process there. One of the challenges we've always had in this state is the issue of local control. So doing some sort of a state-managed system where we set it up and we follow this track. But to mandate it and to mandate specific classes has been something that the state has resisted. How do we get away from that and convince everyone in the legislature to vote your way of thinking?
Excellent question. The Constitution says we have to provide the education, not necessarily micromanage it. See, you need teachers to micromanage education. So I want to go to a voucher system and put the money in the school building, in the teachers, in teacher pay, and in teaching materials, and in that way. But I want to support all facets of delivering education, homeschoolers, private schools, church schools, charter schools, public schools. And so now we will introduce competition into the delivery of education, and we will see our results improve. The state will provide a suggested curriculum. However, there will be schools, parents will be free to choose curriculum, and then we'll see how that works out. Right now, we're not doing very well. We're the seventh in the country in spending. We're not seventh in performance, but even if we were, that wouldn't be very good. In 2015, we were 41st in the world in math and in the mid-20s in reading and science. That's unacceptable. 40% or so of the engineers in Silicon Valley are foreign-born. I'm not opposed to bringing in foreign talent, but I want to educate our children to that same level and then fill in the gap with foreign talent.
How do you make a voucher system work, though, in Wyoming? Obviously, it can work in a place like Cheyenne where you've got a lot of schools. But if we're talking about, you know, Douglas or some of our more rural schools, even smaller than that, how do you make that work?
Excellent question. So the parents get the voucher, they get the account for their children, and then they can work with their school board on curriculum, but they can also, there are a lot of homeschoolers around the state, and they'll be supported. They pay taxes. They'll be supported. Private schools may spring up. But what was found in a state like Wisconsin, which really surprised me, the public schools improved a great deal when a voucher system was placed in that state. Now, they got a lot more population than we have. Okay, cool. In our smaller rural communities, I think the voucher system will allow some competition between public school, homeschoolers, etc., which will drive the delivery education, but also bypasses a lot of administrative overburden, if you will, which is largely federally mandated. So I think it could work very well.
Taylor Haynes visiting with us, a Republican candidate for governor. You talked earlier about not liking Endow. I guess the pushback would be, we talk about diversifying the economy, and if somebody's not leading the way, how do we ever get there?
Excellent question, and really a very appropriate pushback. To diversify your economy, one of the things we need is a well-educated, well-trained, diversified workforce. And my changing how we deliver education will provide that. The other thing we need to do, we do brag about no income tax, and so far no income tax, and if Taylor's governor, there won't be an income tax. But there are a lot of behind-the-scenes taxes where we pay property tax on equipment and things that we purchased. And then there's a regulatory overburden partly and even sometimes greatly due to federal interference in our state. You relieve that regulatory overburden, and regulation should be public health and safety only, not architectural style and the other things that they've put into the building codes. We need to back away from international building codes and go back to our architectural building codes and our ASME codes, which were basically public health and safety, structural integrity, that kind of thing. When you do that, when you reduce regulation so that people can survive, Bill, the entrepreneurs will diversify our economy. There's a lot of talk about completely getting away from our natural resource base. No, we will never get away from our base, and I have no intention of doing that. That is our strength. We can build on that base. And we're already diversified because even though we have huge natural resource base, there are a lot of service industries and add-on industries and value-added. And I want to do much more with value-added. I want to have power plants here and ship the power out. I want to do more in that area of value-added to our natural resource base. But I want to do that by making the climate attractive to entrepreneurs. And therefore, then I don't have to choose an industry to support. The marketplace will choose the industry. And that's the difference between my philosophy, which is an Adam Smith economic philosophy. Endow is a Keynesian, J. Maynard Keynes philosophy, that the government stimulates economy. So that's the difference.
One of the things you talked about, the tax situation, and it's maybe not so much about raising taxes where I'm going here with this question, but it's more about maybe evening things out a little bit. When you talk to the energy folks, they'll frequently point out that they're paying a lot more than the rest of us, and we can have another argument or discussion about whether or not that's appropriate. But one of the things that has come up in the revenue meetings the last couple of years is that it's not a very fair system. You've got some people that aren't hardly paying anything, and in some cases get sales tax exemptions where other people are paying quite a bit. The revenue committee is probably going to look at evening that out. Do you support that?
I support evening it out. We all have rights that we talk about. We're all protected by our Constitution. So we all have a responsibility to pay our share. I don't have any problem with that. I'm not really a friend or a backer of exemptions. I really think if you're a citizen, if you're in the milieu, you have a responsibility. There's nothing wrong with evening it out. The thing that I'm talking about is behind the scenes, not only taxes, but so many building inspections when someone's trying to build or remodel, and a bunch of things like that that have nothing to do with safety, have to do with aesthetics, but aesthetics are only in the eye of the beholder. You know, you and I would choose different cars, different shirts, and so forth, and that's our right, and that's what makes America so much fun. So for evening things out is not a problem. But raising taxes at this point, we don't need to, but we do need to change how we spend our money.
Taylor Haynes visiting with us, and let's talk a little bit about that. Every candidate I've brought in here has told me we still have more cuts to make. Is that your thinking as well?
Well, when you say more cuts to make, yes, but the only thing that I am bound and that I have said I'm going to cut is Endow, and I will. It's dead January 2019, and we're going to go in a different direction. When I take over management of all of this additional infrastructure, if you will, there will be quite a bit of shifting of employees in state government around and changing of some state agencies. Maybe some will go away. There may even be a new agency or two. But we're going to restructure our government, so there will be a lot of work to be done. But when you talk about taking over an enterprise with about 8,000 employees, 100 state agencies or so, depending on how you look at them, you want to be careful with that. You want the thing to run as you change directions. And when I say run, I don't want total chaos. I want the thing to run. There'll be fear. There'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth just because we're making change. So just to say, I'm going to come in, boy, God, and we're going to cut. Stop. I'm going to come in and we're going to restructure how we do things. And we're going to move some people around to where they'll be needed with this new revenue, with this new enterprise for us to run. But I'm just, except for Endow and that type of spending, I'm not going to promise to cut anything else at this point.
Can I ask you, since you have such experience as a University of Wyoming trustee, how you've viewed some of the things that have happened on this campus recently? Trustees certainly getting a little bit more control of the campus and on spending. This is an area I know you know a lot about on this campus, and I'm just kind of curious if you're concerned where the trustees are going or if you think it's appropriate.
I'll tell you what I'm concerned about. I understand we lost some engineering professors because we didn't compete on salary, but we're spending $82 million on a new building. What I'm going to look at is this, and first of all, I set a goal. For the University of Wyoming, my goal is to move this university well into the top 100 research universities in our country. That's what we need to be because we're a small state, small population, and we can compete with the Ivies and the Stanfords of the world with our academic prowess. We've got the infrastructure, and I want the trustees and administration to take us in that direction. Well, that said, it's the professors, it's the researchers that make you what you are, not the buildings. So I want to change that philosophy. Now, do I want hovels? No. Do I want unsafe buildings? No. But I don't want architectural wonders either. I want buildings that are functional, work, and work well, they're airy and safe, but I want the money spent on the people in the front of the classroom, and I want the world-class researchers and the world-class graduate assistants. That's what makes a research university, and so that's where I'm going with it. So it's a bit more of a different direction with an urgency rather than a slower pace.
But you were on the trustees, and you know there are smart trustees, and some maybe not as up to speed as the others. Do you think the trustees should be the ones doing most of the running of the university, or do you leave that to the administration? Because I think we're starting to see a shift here.
I absolutely think the administration should run the university. A board, whether it's the board of trustees of a university or the board of trustees of a corporation, a board is to take the long view. Managing this institution day-to-day is clearly the responsibility of the president, her administration, and your deans and department heads. That's who should run the university. The trustee sets the tone. The trustees make some rules in general, but you let your pros on the ground run your institution.
Taylor Haynes, you're a Republican candidate for governor. I know folks can find out more about you on your website. Dr. Haynes, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That's HaynesForWyoming.com.
Social media has brought us lots of things, from Instagrammed food pics to the ubiquitous selfie, and, of course, a tweeting president. But how about brand ambassadors? These are people who have huge followings on platforms like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And for a price, they'll highlight certain company brands when they post. As Maggie Mullen reports, one such ambassador has set off a huge upset in the world of fly fishing.
Ryan Hudson would describe himself as a bit of a hermit.
I don't like to deal with people. I hide out.
Hudson lives in the small town of Daniel, Wyoming, population 150. For the last 14 years, he's worked as a fly fishing guide. But a recent cover photo on the January edition of American Angler caused Hudson to step out of his quiet world and write an op-ed.
I just thought, boy, this is gonna create a lot of nonsense in my life.
He was right. His op-ed criticizing the photo of a well-known angler and brand ambassador went viral. In the picture, the angler is showing off the roughly 2-foot-long brown trout he just caught.
The cover clearly depicted the bones coming out of that fish's tail. And
any skilled angler will tell you that means it's spawning. Fish are particularly vulnerable at this stage of their life cycle and easier to catch. Hudson says it's not unusual to see inexperienced anglers targeting them. It's not illegal. But for experienced anglers, it's a shady practice.
Why do we want to interrupt them when they are putting eggs in the ground that have a small chance of survival to begin with? That's why they lay hundreds, if not thousands, of eggs.
In his op-ed, Hudson said he's concerned by the lengths so-called brand ambassadors will go to get the perfect picture.
But social media, you know, it's your own personal bragging board. We all have the right to post a picture of something really cool we were just involved in.
But not, he says, if you have to do something unethical, like catch a spawning fish to get the shot. The angler at the center of this debate is Patrick Duke, a brand ambassador from Colorado. He declined our request for an interview, but in a public Facebook post, he apologized and said, quote, "I hope that those who know me as a person of high class and moral character will not formulate a new negative opinion about me or the brands that I am affiliated with."
Anytime you use a real person associated with a brand, they're a real person.
That's Elizabeth Mitten, a marketing professor at the University of Wyoming.
And they'll post information about, sometimes it's the brands that they're using, it's the activities that they're pursuing, it's the best spots that they're going to, it's their latest adventure. And a lot of times it will inspire the followers to try to do the same thing.
Brand ambassadors have made their way into almost every market, telling people how to dress, what to eat, and where to stay on vacation. Mitten says they're really effective for brands, especially smaller ones, because their followers are usually the exact consumers the company wants to reach. Mitten also says people are more likely to trust them.
They're perceived as unbiased, more trusted than a lot of other sources of advertising. And so that a smaller brand can get their name out there more easily and potentially increase sales that way.
Probably the most visible brand ambassadors in the angling world, though, are with Orvis, one of the oldest and largest fly fishing companies in the world. Company spokesperson Steve Hempkins says the company depends on brand ambassadors to help encourage newcomers to the sport.
It's not something that you just are going to wake up one day and say, I want to fly fish.
From gear to difficult techniques, it's a steep learning curve, and Hempkins says brand ambassadors are relatable and credible figures who can help newbies with those hurdles.
People look at what the signals that we send as an industry leader, and then they kind of use that to as guardrails for their own behavior.
Hempkins says Orvis does not support targeting spawning fish as part of that behavior, but he doesn't think brand ambassadors are to blame for an apparent uptick in unethical practices like this.
Everyone has a DSLR camera and their iPhone in their pocket. Many people carry really great cameras, and so there's tons of content flying around in every direction.
At the same time, he does say it will be up to the companies, the brands, to fix the problem.
We're not doing our industry, our shareholders, the fisheries any favors.
By putting untrained anglers on a crowded river, he says, an interest in fly fishing is on the increase. With more men and women wading out into moving rivers, ethical and sustainable fishing practices may become more of a moving target. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, a story about the battle over changing the name of Yellowstone National Park. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. A controversy over the names of two landmarks in Yellowstone National Park highlight a forgotten genocide in the U.S. and how historical awareness, conflicting narratives, and misinformation help muddy the waters. Nate Hedgie has more.
On a cold January day more than a century ago, U.S. troops massacred nearly 200 Piikani people on a Montana riverbank. A few were young men.
The rest were women and children and old folks. It's hard to imagine.
That's Chief Stanley Charles Greer of the Piikani Nation in Alberta, Canada. And the people killed were his ancestors. Accounts of the massacre are brutal. Soldiers killed a mother breastfeeding her baby. They shot sick people hiding under blankets.
Survivors were basically executed at the by axes, and that's pretty barbaric.
And the man who helped perpetrate this massacre was Lieutenant Gustavus Doan. He was 29 years old then. In photos, he's wearing a soldier's uniform with combed black hair and a massive waxed mustache. Doan later went on to explore parts of Yellowstone, and his compatriots named Mount Doan after him. The name stuck. But for Chief Stanley Charles Greer, Mount Doan is a celebration of violence perpetrated against his people.
Doan led that attack and fully implemented the massacre. And as a result of that, we feel that's an atrocity to humanity, and it's essentially war crime.
So last September, Greer joined tribal leaders from across North America at the gates of Yellowstone National Park. A couple rode horses and some leaders wore cowboy hats. They were there asking the Park Service to change Mount Doan's name to First Peoples Mountain. They also want to rename the iconic Hayden Valley. The person it's named after was one of the first surveyors of Yellowstone, Ferdinand Hayden. Hayden wasn't involved in the Piikani massacre, but the tribes accuse him of calling for the extermination of American Indians. They point to Hayden's written works, including statements made about Native Americans in his 1871 geological survey.
Unless they are localized and made to enter upon agricultural and pastoral pursuits, they must ultimately be exterminated.
This sentence in particular has been widely quoted by historians, in a book commissioned by the National Park Service, by the tribes, and most recently, local, national, and international press. But as we comb through the 150-year-old document, it turns out Hayden didn't write those words. They were actually written by one of Hayden's colleagues, Sirius Thomas. Hayden did compile the full report, however, and gave Thomas's words his blessing when he presented it to the U.S. government.
He basically incited this, what we would call hatred towards indigenous peoples at that time in his policies, in his written statements.
Earlier this year, Park County commissioners in Wyoming voted against changing Mount Doan and Hayden Valley. They said people here like those names. They're used to them.
This has nothing to do with the Native Americans.
That's Jake Fulkerson, one of the commissioners.
I mean, there was one article that we saw that said commissioners against the Indians or something, and that's garbage.
With Hayden, he says the issue is overblown. Who doesn't have a skeleton in their closet?
I mean, if you go around digging up dirt on people and changing names everywhere, I mean, where once this horse leaves the barn, where does it end?
But Fulkerson and the other county commissioners don't make the ultimate decision. They can only make a recommendation to a federal body that will. It's called the U.S. Board on Geographic Names, and Lou Yost is the guy in charge.
The board places a great deal of emphasis on local use or acceptance of a name or a name change.
The board's researchers also compile historical documents and corroborate accusations. And in this case, they found mountains of evidence against Gus Doan. In one letter, Doan talks about watching a stream of Piikani blood flow down a frozen river. In short, the investigation showed he's every bit as bad as the tribe suggests. But racist accusations against Ferdinand Hayden are not so clear. As with his geological report, other racist remarks attributed to him were actually written by different authors in reports Hayden helped edit. This research, along with local recommendations, will be given to the board so they can make a final decision. Before that happens, though, they still need a recommendation from the National Park Service. And when I asked outgoing Yellowstone Superintendent Dan Wenk about it a month ago, he said Yellowstone's prominence amongst national parks makes any decision a big deal.
I think it's a decision that has to be made in a larger context than just Yellowstone.
Once the Park Service finally pitches in, the U.S. Board on Geographic Names could decide on whether to rename one or both of the landmarks as early as this fall. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgie.
Steve.
Steve Mathis is a Jackson native and a wildlife photographer. A couple of years ago, he fell in love with photographing great gray owls. It turns out they aren't that easy to find, but he got the hang of it. And this year, one of his striking photos of the owl won the Audubon Society Grand Prize Award. Mathis spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska on how he's learned to spot great gray owls. But first, Kudelska asks about the story behind the winning photo.
That particular photograph was taken last fall. I've been working on a photo book and a collaboration with a local biologist who studies owls for the past 5 years or so. And as part of getting images together for that book, I spend a lot of time photographing great gray owls. This past fall, gone on kind of a drought, about a six-week drought of not seeing an owl for a while. And one evening, I was out hiking around looking for owls, as usual, and saw one flying across a meadow about, 150 yards away from me at the time. So I took off running after it and was able to locate it while it was perched up hunting, and followed it around for the rest of the evening until it was too dark to photograph anymore. During the course of that evening, it gave me a bunch of really nice photo opportunities, and one of those opportunities resulted in the photo that won the Audubon Grand Prize Award. And it was, mm-hmm. Yep, go ahead.
I was just going to ask if you can describe what the owl is doing in that photo.
The owl had gone down to hunt after a gopher, and it was not successful. And as it flew back up onto a nearby branch, the branch flexed underneath its weight, and it kind of sent the owl off balance a little bit. And so as it was struggling to regain its balance, it was kind of gyrating its wings in some very interesting positions to kind of right itself on that branch. And during that kind of struggle to maintain balance, I snapped that photo, and I had just kind of had the perfect wing position and perfect background, and it was staring right down the barrel of the lens. So everything came together on that one.
When you took that photo, did you know right away that was going to be a good one?
I knew one of those images was going to be really excellent. You never know if like the owl's going to be blinking or something that could ruin the image, but I knew somewhere in there was going to be a really killer photo. And then when I did get home and review the images, that was the one. Like the second I saw it, I knew that was the best photo. And it usually takes me a little while to kind of digest an image and really be able to objectively evaluate it. But that one from day one, I knew was going to be one of my best owl images ever.
And so you mentioned that you go looking for owls. How do you know where to find owls?
Well, that's the big question. The first time I decided I wanted to photograph a great gray owl, I had seen some beautiful images of great gray owls, and I decided I'm going to go photograph a great gray owl. And I'd spent 8 months looking for the first one before I finally found one. So during that 8 months, I learned a lot about their habitat and kind of their patterns, and tried to learn as much as I could about their biology, how they hunt, where they hunt, where they winter, where they summer, all those things. And then the first time I found one, of course, it was very exciting, and I decided I wanted to do that a bunch more.
And you mentioned earlier that they're one of the favorite wildlife that you like to photograph. And why is that?
I can't explain it, to be honest. That's a question that people ask me, and I don't know. There's just something about that species of owl I tend to like a lot more than other species as well. So there's just some kind of an aura or a mystique with owls, and great gray owls in particular seem to be very charismatic, and they also seem to be more tolerant of me and I think people than a lot of owl species. They also hunt sometimes in enough light to actually make good photos, whereas a lot of owls are completely nocturnal and you just can't photograph them in the dark.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska speaking with Jackson photographer Steve Mathis, who won Audubon Society's Grand Prize Award for a photo of a great gray owl in Teton County.
Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear an individual segment, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You'll never miss the show if you sign up for our podcast on that website or on iTunes. Anna Rader is our web editor. Our stories are also available on social media, including the station Facebook page.
We are always looking for good ideas for interviews or stories. We'd love to hear from you. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.